So my first column I wrote about Jimmy Young. And the BBC is also born and armed to make war. BBC Radio is totally under siege from BBC Television.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Gillian Reynolds.
Well, because I was born in 1935, I grew up with the radio. And I grew up with the radio being on in the house, and it was a very different kind of radio. It was big. It had a wooden front, the one in my grandma's house.
Here is the last news bulletin for today.
And I remember them all being round the radio for news of the bombing of Ethiopia. Hearing them all very hushed and hearing the radio quite booming voice talking about the bombing on the news. You know, I must have been about 3, 4. And I also remember, as Rob Wilton would have said, the day war broke out.
And that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
And then shortly after that we moved into our own council house about half a mile away on a rougher estate. We had our own radio, and that had a brown face. And I remember learning to read. I could read before I was 5. I could read before I went to school. And then I began to read the names on the dial of the radio. Kallenberg, Luxembourg. I could read these names. So radio is an indissoluble part of my childhood. You're going on through the Blitz, coming out, listening to the shows that were on the radio, Works Playtime. A lot of American comedy, Jack Benny and Mary Livingstone in Rochester.
You know, Rochester, I just can't understand it.
What, boss?
Well, the Colemans and I are next-door neighbors. And when Ronnie first moved in, I used to go to all his parties. But the last few years, he's had a dozen big affairs, and I haven't received an invitation to a single one of them. What do you suppose it could be?
Maybe you lost your address.
And Fred Allen sometimes, and Bob Hope later. Also listening through my later years when serials began. Dick Barton, Jackson of the Jungle, then Paul Temple.
The BBC presents Peter Cook and Marjorie Westbury in a new Francis Durbridge serial, Paul Temple and the Gilbert Case.
When I got into the upper fifths at school a long time later, our headmistress said, "Are you listening to the 54 Society?" I think it was on the third programme. And we all said yes, but we weren't. Because radio was meant to have a dimension beyond the entertaining. By and large, that had passed me by, really.
This is the BBC third programme.
When we discovered commercial radio, when my brother and I were, 12, 13, we used to listen to Radio Erin. And that was commercial radio. And it seemed so exotic. And we listened to this show that was sponsored. I think it was a comedy show. I think it was Jimmy O'Dea, and we loved it. It was sponsored by Donnelly Sausages, and we never heard of Donnelly Sausages in Liverpool. And then one day they came, and because we were intrigued by these thought of skinless sausages, yes, it's true, it's the talk of the nation, a sausage entirely new, so new it caused a sensation. And Donnelly's make it for you, so the next time you visit your grocer, tell him no other sausage will do. To his other suggestion, say, "No, sir, it's Donnelly's sausages for you." And we bought these Donnelly's sausages, and we peeled off the outer wrap, and then we peeled off the plastic, and very carefully we cooked them, and they were horrible. By the time I was into the upper fifths at school, television was coming along. We'd by that time moved from to a parlour house of our own. Television was coming along, and by that time our fortunes were looking up. Having been stony broke forever, my mother started her own business. Her mother had a stall in the market. My mother got a stall, and she bought a television. So when it was the coronation, all my cousins came round, and they sat in rows on chairs and the floor, and we all watched the coronation.
And for the first time in history, through the medium of television, the ancient and noble rite of a coronation service will be witnessed by millions of Her Majesty's subjects.
And radio would appear to have been forgotten because television, although it took ages to warm up and the picture was a bit bizarre, and it was black and white, of course, and the picture shook, it was a wonder. But radio was still in tandem with television, mostly because television's hours were limited, but we all knew it to be the modern marvel. So the years go by, listening to Radio Luxembourg on a Sunday afternoon for the top 20.
This is Radio Luxembourg on our new frequency, 208 metres on the medium wave band.
I remember Pearl Carr and Teddy Johnson and Beloved Be Faithful being top of the pops. And I remember my first serious boyfriend giving me a kiss on the doorstep that lasted the whole length of Unforgettable by Nat King Cole.
Unforgettable.
And then I got to university. This was 1954, so things were still pretty war front. I mean, rationing had just ended. You still had to put your butter dish out every Friday afternoon to have your ration of butter put in it. Nobody had radios, except people who were really, really rich, or had been given them for 21st presents. People didn't get presents when they were 18 in the olden days. And we all used to cluster around anybody who actually had a radio and listen there until we listened to the Goons, everybody spellbound and rapt.
I don't get a good vibe.
It's a police inspector standing in a tobacconist's window with a postcard pinned to him. What does it say?
Amateur photographer needs a beautiful model.
Not that police inspector.
So we used to listen to American Forces Network.
Music fills the darkened room and shares the mood of love as two pairs of eyes look longingly into each other. Welcome to the world of love, the world of midnight in Europe.
By this time, we had a radiogram, and your ear would be pressed up because the signal would fade to listen to Woody Herman and the very first sounds coming out of the West Coast. Stan Kenton, then Shorty Rogers, who'd played with Stan Kenton, and then all the others. When I left Oxford, I went on a graduate year to America, to an American college, way out in the middle of nowhere. I still didn't have my own radio. In 1957, a radio was still a considerable investment. It was pre-transistor. And because I didn't intend to stay at Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Massachusetts, longer than a year, I didn't reckon on making this investment. So I spent all my money going and listening to live jazz. I came back to Britain briefly, got married in Liverpool, went back to America, and that was when the radio came into its own, because I was married, my husband was a reporter on the Providence Journal, and we didn't have a television, we had a radio. And I discovered talk radio, I discovered phone-in radio, and I used to listen to these discussions on in and around Providence, because the concept of many overlapping stations was a bit foreign to someone who'd grown up in this country.
If anybody shows you a photo, let's say it's your school graduation photo, or the time you were on that camping trip, or the time you were on the fishing trip, or wherever you were, and there are several people in the photo, maybe there's 10, maybe there's 20, maybe there's 30, maybe there's 100. Whose likeness do you seek out? Whose countenance do you study?
And I began to winnow out favourites and unfavourites. And there was one particular talk radio show I used to listen to. And one day they were talking about the iniquities of the National Health Service. So I thought, it's time I rang up. So I rang up and I said, I'm afraid you've got this all wrong. And I put on this really posh accent and I clearly explained in words of one syllable the aims and achievements of the National Health Service. And at the end of it, the phone-in host, this tirade, which must have lasted a couple of minutes, the phone-in host said, well, I don't know what you were saying, but that was a cute little voice. And then we came back to England in 59. My husband got a job at the Daily Post and Echo in Liverpool. Our oldest son was born in 1960 in Liverpool. And again, I started listening to the radio again. I mean, there was television there, and we watched television, of course. But if you're feeding a baby, there's nothing like the radio to keep you company. You know, I've been pregnant 3 times. I've got 3 sons. Well, I've been pregnant more times, and I've had miscarriages and stuff. But all of that time is linked with breastfeeding or feeling sad or sharing happiness. And when we moved to London, when Stanley worked for Reuters, 3 8-hour shifts, and he'd be out overnight. My friends clubbed together, my friends from Oxford clubbed together and bought me a transistor radio, which I think it cost £17.10, which was my husband's take-home pay from Reuters. So it was still the riches of the universe if you were living on a budget, which I was. But the radio became a sort of both reflection and anticipation of my own moods. If it was a Friday and I was feeling happy and I was washing the clothes in the bath as usual, I'd learned to wash sheets in the bath when I lived in Providence, Rhode Island. Friday afternoon, Val Dunican, it was a show on the light programme, and it was an absolute haven.
This is the BBC light programme.
And to this day, I think I know all the words of Paddy McGuinty's Goat. Still. Patrick McGuinty, an Irishman of note, fell into a fortune and bought himself a goat.
To see sure of goat's milk, I'm going to have me fill. But when he brought the nanny home, he found it was a bill. All the young ladies...
Well, I was by this time a bit sophisticated, so I used to tune around between the Home Service and occasionally Radio 3. And I would hear my Oxford contemporaries on Radio 3, Edward Lucy Smith, then a legend, when I was at Oxford, who was a published poet, and I would hear him spouting on.
And what are you looking for when you make a portrait?
Oh, just, well, actually, I try to make people look good.
And I heard Ed Mullins, who I'd known at Oxford, who was a great art critic, and I would hear them on The Critics on Radio 3, and I would think, my life is a failure. Here I am, washing the sheets in the bathtub. Will I never be famous? And then, you know, fate is cruel. My mother died very suddenly, age 55, in Liverpool in 1962. It was just the world falling in on me, just absolutely falling in on me. But it was really, really hard. And that was where the radio, because it is such a personal medium, it feels so intimate, it feels as if it's almost inside your head, was so wonderful, because I would turn it on, and whether it was music or speech, it was my mind going into another world, not feeling totally overwhelmed by what do we do about the business, what do we do about the bank account, who should we tell, what do you do to get a death certificate. All of that seemed to recede into the distance, because there was another world, tranquil world outside this. That was huge, unconscious help in the great transition to being really grown up, because it's only when your mother dies that you grow up. Being at home quite a bit, I got to know various sort of landmarks in the day, like the Archers or that Brian Redhead show on a Saturday night, or family favourites.
But at home and away, once again, it's time for two-way family favourites. Damp but unbowed, let us call our Sunday man in Cologne, Ian Fenner. Are you there, Ian?
I'd got to know that kind of variety of programming, and I'd also got to like classical music a bit more. But I started working in television in 1964, and I was commuting down to London and doing a programme here, a live programme, 3 times a week. I'd come down, and it was a live conversational show called 3 After 6, which Rediffusion, who then held the weekday franchise for commercial television in London, proposed instead of regional news.
Broadcasting on the London station of the Independent Television Authority, this is Rediffusion.
They would have a three-way conversation about that which was in the news today, whether it was the weather, or a particular news story, or some cultural event. And there would be 3 or 4 topics. And the three people were Jack Hargreaves, sometimes Robert Key, sometimes Benny Green, Alan Bryan, who was a theatre critic, and me. And for 6 weeks, I was the woman, or as Christopher Booker, who was then the Spectator's television critic, called me, a perky Liverpudlian bird. I've never let him forget it. So, and then I really couldn't stand the pace, because I was doing the business, going to London, doing the show. It's got a lot of work. So I took a bit of a, a rest from that. And then I started working in television in the Northwest. And then I did a big network documentary, again, for Rediffusion. In the background, all the time, the solid voice of sense, information, proportion, whether abstract like music or absolutely positive like speech radio, documentary radio, was BBC Radio. And then along came the advent of BBC local radio.
This is BBC Radio Leicester.
And The Guardian knew me by this time because Stanley had been working on The Guardian staff for a few years. He was a columnist by then, very well established. And I'd done the odd theatre review. In fact, not more than the odd. I'd done a lot of the theatre reviews in Liverpool because they knew I could do it in time. What you did was, you know, you go and see the show. You never walk out before the end. Stanley told me that. I said, why not? What if it's boring? He said, you've got to stay to the very end. Because who knows? The lights may go out. Someone may drop dead. There may be an accident. If it's Macbeth, someone may hit each other with a sword. You never know. You've got to stay to the end. Then you run out, you write it down, and you ring it in to the copy taker. So I used to do the Playhouse, occasionally the Empire Theatre, and the Royal Court Theatre in Liverpool, and the Everyman. So I used to do review plays. And I have got myself in print dismissing the likes of Simon Callow and Ian McKellen. In 1967, The Guardian had a bit of a revolution. The late Philip Hope Wallace, the drama critic, had once said to my husband, never work for The Guardian, Stanley, the bastard sack you on Christmas Eve. And they'd had a bout of this. And it ended up with Brian Redhead, who was then the Northern editor of The Guardian, saying to Stanley he'd like him to be the television critic. And Stanley was very happy with that. And the Northern features editor said to me, would you like to be the radio critic? And I thought that was really good because I'd listened to the radio all this time and I knew loads of stuff about everything because all kinds of programmes were absolutely going great guns then. On Radio 4, Analysis was doing amazing stuff.
Quite the best buy in American bookshops just before Christmas was a slim volume called The Liberated Woman's Appointment Calendar and Survival Handbook for 1971, complete with a potted karate lesson and a hostility dartboard decorated with the face of Sigmund Freud.
Predicting all kinds of things. Like the other day when Theresa May mentioned having worker representation on boards, I remember Germany had it long before us because I'd heard it all discussed on Analysis. Anyway, I started working for The Guardian. He wrote every night. I wrote once a week. And we both phoned our copy in. The first column I wrote for The Guardian was a bit controversial. When Andy Shane wasn't doing it, they'd had several very good people, but rather highbrow people do it. And they'd always just done drama. And I was resolved that I would reflect the wider pattern of radio. I would reflect the coming of local radio, the coming of pop radio, with radios 1 and 2 was still off the horizon. But Jimmy Young was there on Radio 2, and nobody had really written, as far as I could see, about Jimmy Young.
Get a little swing into your mid-morning listening. Tune in to the J.Y. Show. Millions hear it, millions say it. The Jimmy Young Show is a swinger, a winner. It's on radios 1 and 2 at 10.
So my first column I wrote about Jimmy Young and predicted that this would be a precursor of many things. I thought no more about it, being rather an arrogant person. Years later, it came back to me that Alistair Hetherington, The Guardian's editor, had had a fit and said, is this the kind of thing she's going to go on writing about? Because our readers don't expect it. And John Corse, who'd hired me, said, but she's right, you know, this is what radio is about now.
It's just a week now since the political world was shaken up with the news that a woman was to lead one of Britain's major political parties, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher.
As radio expanded, and first local radio came, and then the BBC reorganised the networks, and then commercial radio, or was on the horizon, I was writing about radio in that great transitional period when on the BBC they never mentioned the opposition, but then as I learned later, BBC Radio was totally under siege from BBC Television. They thought, why waste money on this? It's the past. We are the future. Spend all the budget on us. And it was only 10, 12, 15 years later, reading as people's memoirs came out, how radio had been, BBC Radio, which was, you know, the fountain of so much original stuff, people broadcasting in their own words, phone-ins, all of this stuff had been resisted by the other half of the BBC, the powerful part of the BBC, television, that had the money, the kudos and the profile. So by the time commercial radio was on the horizon, I was really looking forward to the new challenge. But by that time, I was also quite involved in local life in Liverpool. I was on all kinds of committees, the Liverpool Leader Society, adult literacy campaign, state education campaigns, and so on. And the Arts Council mag asked me to write a piece for their quarterly mag about what I thought an ideal commercial radio station for Liverpool would be like. It so happened I'd eaten a piece of off liverwurst, you know, in that terrible wartime spirit of never let a piece that isn't obviously bad go to waste. So I'd eaten this bad piece of liverwurst. And so I was up all night and I thought I wouldn't waste being up all night between bouts of spewing, and I would make a start on this piece. And you know, by the next day I had the piece more or less written. And I wrote it, touched it up a bit, sent it in, and I got a phone call from Terry Smith, who I knew a bit because we'd worked together in television, and I knew a bit about the reputation of his news agency, and I knew how hard he'd worked and how much he'd worked at Radio Merseyside. And he said, I'm getting together, I really liked what you wrote, I'm getting together a consortium to apply for the Liverpool franchise, would you be interested? I said, oh no, not my kind of thing at all. And he persisted, and he said, you know, that was such a good idea about doing this. And in the end, I said, oh, all right then, why not? And so we got together the consortium, and we differed in many things, but we agreed in more things than we differed. And we were up against strong competition, and it was very competitive. We came down to do the interviews, and it was the three-day week, the Edward Heath three-day week, when all the shop lights and all the lights went off at 10 o'clock.
Industry needs power. So do hospitals. So do essential services. At home, you could get by with less. So switch off some power.
And we were down in London, and there was very little transport. And the chairman of our consortium, Ken Medlock, who will be 102 this summer and still flourishes, he was chairman of the Birkenhead Co-op, and he organised a fleet of hearses to transport us from Liverpool to London for our interviews with the Independent Broadcasting Authority, the IBA, which was later... Oh, no, it was the ITA then. It was the ITA. It was only later it became the IBA, because these were the very, very early days. We went through the due process. I felt pretty confident when we came out of the room at the IBA. I felt pretty much like Liza Minnelli in Cabaret, nothing else. And I felt pretty triumphant, and I walked up the road with David Maker, and we both felt pretty confident. And then the letter came several days later, and Terry was jubilant. The Liverpool Daily Post and Echo were within our consortium, because you had to include, or include in your potential shareholders, all of the competing local media. So every consortium in its respective area had to either offer shares to or have shareholdings already from the local newspapers and the local television contractors. The rules were very strict. They were very strict on engineering, very strict on what you could do and how you could do it, and the proportion of speech to music, the importance of meaningful speech, the importance of news. Everything was outlined and underlined to the least degree. And because we were all quite passionate about it, we all swore ourselves up to this great dogma. we knew we had the consortium, and we knew that I would leave The Guardian at the end of March, and that we would aim to have the radio station on the air by the autumn of 74, and that every minute counted. And so I came down to London for some other IBA business and went and did interviews with the people at LBC and at Capital, who were going to be the first two on the air. And LBC sent me packing out of the door. They were far too busy. The dust was flying in there. They were in Gough Square, opposite Dr. Johnson's house in London. And Capital were in this great grandeur on the Euston Road. And I went in and I had half an hour with Michael Bucht, who was then their programme director. And he was quite condescending to me. I'd worked for him a couple of times in television, and he greeted me like an old pal, but then was, you know, very sort of haughty and condescending.
And the reason why Capital owns London is because Capital puts back into its audience what it takes out.
This huge staircase was under construction, and I could see they were under huge pressure. And he said, and I can't spend any more time with you. I've got Kenny Everett to see to. I've got this person to see to. I've got all of these stars to see to. And so I remember closing my notebook with a snap. And I said, thank you so much, Michael. I'll be seeing you later. And indeed I was. The months rolled by and they were on the air. We had the timetable worked out. We would start work on April the 1st, 1974. And we did. And we started work out at Terry's old offices, his old news agency offices, opposite the Mersey Tunnel. We were in Manchester Street for a few months, and then Terry was obviously looking round for premises, and he found an empty warehouse a few streets away in Stanley Street. And he said, would we come and look around it? And it was huge. There was a ground floor, there was a basement, and there was an upstairs. And it was obviously had been a warehouse. And there was a hoist in place, a big mechanical hoist, to bring stuff up through a well. And Terry said, we can have a circular staircase there that goes between the floors. And I knew a bit about circular staircases from friends who'd made money. I said, they cost a fortune. And he said, I think we've got it. And we kind of moved in, and we didn't have any furniture. But Terry had his desk delivered and his office furniture delivered. So there was me, the programme director, there was the news editor, and there was the engineer, Peter Duncan. So there was me, David Maker, Peter Duncan, and Terry. The four of us were in this big building. Only Terry had a desk. We had, I think, scrubby old office chairs. Kitchen chairs, I think, we had to sit on. So one day, David and me got the packing cases, and we made Terry a desk out of the packing cases, and we said, when is ours coming? But by that time, a hole had appeared in the wall between our warehouse and the adjacent one. And we were with Terry, the four of us, all together, and he got a phone call, and he said, make yourselves scarce, he said. The agent's coming round. I haven't signed the lease yet. So we all ran upstairs, David, Peter and me, and we got through the hole in the wall, and we hid behind the hole on the other side of the wall, and we listened as Terry and the agent walked around, and Terry was saying, what do you know about that well, you know, where the hoist's been? I don't know, I mean, look at it. And, you know, he was obviously doing a bargain to get it. And then after a bit, we were shaking with laughter. We were absolutely shaking with laughter, and we came out, and I think it was pretty soon after that that we all got proper desks, and the real business of putting together a radio station began. 1, 9, 4. The great thing about the first 3 years of commercial radio was that very, very few people knew how to do it. They knew the American model, they knew the Australian model, but they didn't actually understand how to apply it in various localities. And by the time we got on the air, LBC had already lost a fortune in just a year. Capital had gone through a terrible phase where the people were being paid in toasters, and Richard Attenborough and John Whitney, the chairman and the managing director, had sent their own personal pictures to the sale room as a guarantee against loans.
I didn't actually sell them. I put them in the boot of the car, and I took them down to the Bank of Scotland, and we went in to plead for an upgrading of our overdraft. And I said, I've got the car downstairs, and I've got five paintings, and they're worth X, and you can have them. I'll bring them up. You can have them as security. And he came back, and he said, no, you can keep your paintings. We'll give you your money.
Nobody actually had the secret, except Jimmy Gordon at Radio Clyde knew how to run broadcasting, because he was a professional broadcaster. He'd worked as a political correspondent for the BBC and for Scottish television. He was very canny with money. He was a good Glaswegian. He understood the score, and he got it right. Clyde made a profit in its first year. That was the third station on the air. BRMB, I think, had a few jitters and starts at the start. But Philip Birch of Piccadilly knew how to do it, because he'd run the most successful pirate. He'd run Radio London, which made the fortunes of many a disc jockey, Tony Blackburn among them. And he knew how to make money. He always says he could have made commercial radio legal much earlier if he'd been allowed to combat the BBC's dirty tricks in getting the Musicians' Union on side, tra-la-la-la. But he said if he'd been allowed to pay Performing Rights Society rights on broadcast music, we could have had commercial radio earlier. So Piccadilly either broke even or made a profit in its first year. But with those two exceptions, everyone else was making it up. Now, I was making it up, but David Maker wasn't. He'd been the news editor at BBC Radio Merseyside. He knew how to do it, and he was a very good guide to me. Peter Duncan, our engineer, had worked at Tyne's Television, had worked for himself. He had his own OB unit, but he had all kinds of broadcasting businesses on the side. So they understood and they guided me. I had a particular vision. I didn't want Scouse radio. I didn't want patronising. All right, lads, we're all in this together. Come on, Gail, where are you? I didn't want that.
Always that there was another way of doing music. I know there is another way of doing news.
I wanted respect. I wanted people to say good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I wanted a flavour of Liverpool. I wanted an absolute reflection of the city. Because like any other big city, Manchester, Birmingham, Leeds, Glasgow, we are not one city. We're all different bits of the city. And you have to reflect them. With Liverpool, it's over the water in the world as well. You had to reflect all those bits, and David and I agreed with this, and his newsroom absolutely reflected that. The news coverage and the sports coverage were what made us credible. So it was this very strong backbone. I was able to bring in new ideas. So we had comedy with John Gorman, with Clive Burrows. We had two comedy shows. Clive encouraged other comedy shows. He'd be called now an intern, our work experience guy, Neil. He had Neil do a programme. We had Alan Bleasdale. An idea I stole shamelessly from BBC Radio Merseyside. I also stole its producer. Robert Cooper came to me from BBC Radio Merseyside with an idea. He said, I've produced Scully with Alan Bleasdale. I think it would be a great one-hour show. I think I could do it. I think it would be really good for the station and for your idea. Will you do it? And I said, what's in it for you? And he said, I'll come with it. I said, what would I do with a producer? He said, you'd be amazed to know. And so I took a leap in the dark. I went to Terry. I said to him, I've got to have this show. He said, how much is it going to cost? So picking a figure out of my left side of my brain, I said, it will cost us £75 a week for Alan Bleasdale to write and perform it and include a repeat. And I've got the company secretary drawing up a contract now. I hadn't, but the idea just occurred to me to do it while I was talking to Terry. And I said, and of course he will need a producer, but we will need a producer, so I will use part of my staff allowance to hire Robert Cooper to produce this. Terry was very dubious. We did it. Not only was it Alan Bleasdale's first regular employment as a writer and a performer, not only was it an instant hit, and when we did the first dipstick audience research after 6 weeks, it was by far the most popular programme, even eclipsing the sports news. It was on at 12 o'clock on a Saturday. It was clearly a winner, thanks to the genius of Alan, thanks to the genius of Robert, who went on to be the BBC's drama producer in the North, then the BBC television drama producer in Northern Ireland, and then network, and then a film producer. He produced Truly Madly Deeply. And, you know, he's a legend. He's also quite bad-tempered, but, you know, he's a genius. That's what you pay for a genius. And with that package, I knew that there was something about doing something different in Liverpool that was right. So that was one good thing I did, apart from the fact that I played Scully's mum. So I can be heard on some of the old tapes saying, "Alan, come here, your dinner's ready."
It's 6:02 on Monday, October the 21st, 1974. For the very first time, this is 194 Radio City broadcasting to Merseyside.
Day one at Radio City. We were going on the air at 6:00. It had been agreed that after the official opening speech, the first record would be You Are the Sunshine of My Life, and then we would go into the regular morning sequence. We'd all been up all night. I mean, the solder was barely dry on the mixing desk. We were all fraught. You are the sunshine of my life. And it pretty well worked. I think it pretty well worked. Memory blurs after that. I think I went home about 3:00 and I couldn't go to sleep. And then I fell. When people say you fall asleep, that day I literally felt as if I was falling through several stories, because I don't think I'd slept for 48 hours. I don't think any of us had slept for 48 hours.
I remember we worked our socks off getting ready for day one. No one complained, though. I have a vivid memory of snatching 10 minutes sleep propped up in the corner of Studio One during a Trails recording session.
But I do remember waking up with a bang on the Sunday morning, because we had a Sunday morning quiz show called Cash and Grab, and nobody had thought of the quiz questions. So I went in at 8:00 in the morning and wrote them. City. By this time, there was quite a number of stations on the air, I think 7 or 8, and we were loosely friends, you know, in different ways. We'd met each other different ways. I knew Michael Box from television. I'd met one way and the other the guys at LBC. I knew the people from Piccadilly. I knew Colin from Piccadilly. And I knew John Russell from BRMB. And I knew Andy Park from Clyde. Because Clyde had been like an older brother to us. They were wonderful, very supportive. So I think it was Michael Bucht who said, "I think we should get together and discuss what we've learned and what we need to know." So we all came to London and we all assembled at Capitol. And Michael, who was a practicing Muslim, went into this strange shuddering, it looked to me, but actually he was praying, he was nodding and he was doing his noon prayers, and as he explained to me later. And then we all went off. Michael was pretty foul-mouthed and rather flirtatious. I was the only woman, and I remember being quite salty with him on that occasion, telling him to knock off the rudery. We all discovered that we had the same problems with our MDs. When we did good stuff, the MDs claimed it. When the MDs made a mistake with sales policy or with any of the many IBA rules, we had to stand up and take the blame. And in those days, you had to take your programme schedule every quarter to the what was then the IBA, changed from the Independent Television Authority to the Independent Broadcasting Authority. You had to take it and have it personally approved. And if we'd made a mistake or they said, "Why have you dropped your classical music slot?" or "Why aren't you spending 3% of your total net revenue on the employment of live musicians?" You see, that was in the contract, word for word. And you knew that the managing director, you can't afford that, you know, don't do it. You'd have to take the rap. So we just thought we'd have this friendly get-together and discuss these things and how we got round it. So we did, and it was actually quite productive. And then the heavy foot came down, and we weren't allowed to meet again. But we did. The bonds had been established, and we had things in common. And there was a kind of trust, you know, slightly shadowed by mistrust between us. But when my morning man, Graham Dean, Michael Bucht wanted him for Capital, and Graham told me, and he was my midday man, and I said, don't do a thing without me. I'll sit in the studio with you and talk you through it, because he was doing the call in his show. Not on air, of course, but the only time Bucht could do this call was at this appointed hour. So he's standing there, and I'm listening into the call, and I said, tell him to go higher. I was gesturing higher. And at the end of it, I came, and you know, they did a good deal. And at the end of the call, I remember, came on the line, and I said, Michael, you've got yourself a good man there. And he said, were you listening? And I said, of course I was listening. He's my lad. I took him from the biscuit factory. He's yours now. Because there was a biscuit factory, a biscuit manufacturer, who had their own internal radio system, and half the DJs in the first wave of British commercial radio came out of the biscuit factory, and Graham was one of them. Graham D.
That lovely laid-back version of Lean On Me, original hit version from Bill Withers. It's Tuesday, the 15th of November, and the time exactly 8:30.
I was with City altogether just under 2 years. And I have to say, office life is not for me. I do not like meetings. I find meetings possibly one of the biggest wastes of time ever. And I was restless. Also, my marriage was under considerable strain. I had 3 children by this time. It was under terrible strain. And I felt very cut off, very excluded from any kind of life other than the radio station or the kind of fraught home life that I was having. So I knew that there was still connections in the journalistic world. And quite slowly I made up my mind that I would quit before the first anniversary of the radio station. We were doing okay. It wasn't a disaster. I wasn't walking away from the smoking ruin. There had been, I think, 3 company secretaries by the time I left. And certainly 2, and possibly 3 sales managers. There was a lot of turmoil in the whole business. This was not uncommon. But I left, I moved to London, and I moved to London just before my 40th birthday. And I started my life again when I was 40. And I'd sent letters to various people that I knew saying that I was leaving the radio station. And quite a lot of them replied. So within a week of being in London, I had a column at the Telegraph. Bill Deeds hired me, took me down to the Stone in the olden days of linotype composition and said, have you noticed something different about our listings from everyone else? And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, look, and then he showed me the page print and he said, our radio listings are in the same size type as the television printings. That's because our readers love the radio every bit as much as they love the television. Like a fool, I didn't say, well, in that case, give me a daily review. I was happy with a weekly review. In fact, it was fortnightly, and then it became weekly, and it's been that way ever since. So I've been with them 40 years.
So if you'd like to be a fly on the wall, you'd be a lot better off reading the Daily Telegraph.
And I also had, within that first week or so, a television contract to do a series for London Weekend Television with Cyril Bennett, who'd been my first employer at Rediffusion when I did 3 After 6. And then other television work came out of that. And then radio work came. And isn't it interesting? I did television first, print second, and radio, appearing on radio, which is in many ways the hardest of all 3, I did that last of all. And I put everything that I'd learned from television and everything that I'd learned from writing for print into talking on the radio and writing about the radio, because I do think it's an incomparable medium.
But the Archer's music to me is a significant signal, because when Ian McIntyre became controller of Radio 4, he moved the Archers from 7:15 to 7:05, and in doing so significantly influenced the dinner times of an awful lot of people.
This is BBC Radio 4.
And I do also think in this country we are immeasurably lucky to have two competing but contrasting, vividly contrasting and consistently innovative sides to the industry. I mean, they pretend to be feudally at war, and in some cases they are. Some companies are born to make war, commercial companies that is, and the BBC is also born and armed to make war. But I respect and admire both sides because I love the innovation that I hear. I mean, LBC has reinvented itself in its lifetime how many times? And look at it now. It is thriving. And only a medium that has some direct connection with the listener can do that. And I think radio is that medium. Writing about radio is bizarre because there are so many things. I used to write down everything I thought I might write about, and I would have a list, two foolscap pages long. And then I decided that wasn't very practical. So what I try to do with the Telegraph is to reflect the most interesting or significant programmes that I've heard in the week. There's usually room for three or four. You can shove more in, but it's only a line. I try to write what the readers want me to write about or would be interested to hear about. There's no use me going endlessly on because I have liked a particular play if I don't think it will connect. So I have to make bridges sometimes, but I also have to sort of, as it were, open the door, which has always been the bridge between the listener and that particular something. And I have to write in a kind of, I think I have to write, in a kind of old-fashioned essay-type way, like Addison and Steele would write in the 18th century. I want to write a little piece that will stand up for consideration a few years on. Not just something you wrap the potato peelings in. I want it to be something that people will say, that gave me a good laugh, I kept it. The downside to this is that if you do write something memorable and it's horrible about someone, you may find yourself, as David Byrne would say in Talking Heads, you may find yourself in a room and a person will come striding towards you, reaching into their inside pocket to produce a tattered yellow cutting and say, you destroyed my life, you bitch, you wrote this about me. But that doesn't happen very often. Well, I don't think there's any particular reason to remember me. I mean, one's children are the genetic traces that you leave. I think that's my children. You know, how would I like to be remembered? Well, I'd like to be remembered as someone who gave people a laugh from time to time.
We might have been invaded and the radio was there. You trusted it.
Okay, well, I've got a radio over there. I've got three in the kitchen. I've got the little one that I carry around with me, which is AM, old-fashioned, portable, Sony. You can listen to the radio through that, obviously. And you can hear Good Morning Scotland through that, which is great, and I use all of that. I've got a wind-up radio. I've got a radio that's plugged into the mains because I can't be arsed changing the batteries. In there, I've got a digital radio tuner, which is now a bit of an antique, but I still got it. So that's in there. I've got numerous actual digital radios.
This is 194 Radio City.
I don't have a fully functional digital radio that works off batteries. I've got one in the back bedroom that's plugged into the mains, and you know, so I can walk between all the rooms. This is not untypical, but it still gives me such a kick when you go to, I go to cricket matches whenever I can. And if it's Test Match Special, you see everybody sitting around with Test Match Special in their ears, watching the play. And you know that these days you could watch the television on your phone, you could listen to the radio on your phone. They've actually got little radios because it's more than a radio, is bigger than a phone, isn't it? It is.